Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Fortcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Anderson, CEO and President of Fort Healthcare and Ear, Nose, and Throat Doc. I'm very excited to have a very special guest on this edition of the Fortcast. As you know, it is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and with us today is Dr. Scott Steele. Dr. Steele is a world expert in all of colorectal disease, including cancer. I'm very pleased to announce that he is the chair of the Department of Colorectal Surgery at the Cleveland Clinic and also serves as the president of the main campus of the Cleveland Clinic. He is the author of numerous medical texts, chapters, and publications in the scientific journals, and also has either authored or co-authored numerous national guidelines in the world of colorectal surgery. So, Dr. Steele, thank you so much for joining us today on this episode of the Fortcast. I really appreciate you being here.
Well, thanks, Mike. It's an honor to be here and a pleasure to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart, trying to fight colorectal cancer.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that. I do want to mention that Dr. Steele has his own podcast with some colleagues called Butts and Guts, which is one of the most creative names of a medical podcast. The Fortcast is right up there with Butts and Guts. That's just my personal opinion, Dr. Steele.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things that when I came to the clinic, I wanted to start a podcast and I wanted a little bit of a catchy name. And I was excited that when we got mentioned in the New York Times article about it, they also liked the name. So I appreciate it very much.
Yeah. Well done. So part of this month with colorectal awareness, we had a wonderful podcast with one of our physician surgeons, Dr. Contney, a couple of weeks ago on colorectal screening and the importance of it, including colonoscopies. So Dr. Steele, I'd like to kind of pick up where that conversation left. And obviously, colorectal screening is just so vital. But if somebody goes through a colonoscopy and a mass is discovered and it is malignant, what happens after that? If you could just educate our listeners on what happens next.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. So I think it's always important to start out this conversation with going back to the basics of the human body and a little bit about anatomy. So the lower GI tract, the colon, rectum, and anus, is about 6 feet long in the average person. And so it's important to understand, and I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later, the differences of how we approach a colon cancer versus a rectal cancer. And I tell my patients all the time that we're kind of one long garden hose from our mouths to our bottoms, each serving a different kind of part to it, and they're each shaped a little bit differently. But specifically in the colon, rectum, and anus, it actually, because of its position in the human body, with the rectum being within the pelvis proper and having a group of lymph nodes that is right behind that, and the colon being a little bit more kind of floppy inside of your abdomen, we treat those a little bit different ways. And so with any cancer, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, any sort of a cancer, well, the first thing we want to do after we get that pathological diagnosis is to stage that cancer. So staging, again, as you probably have heard on the Fortcast in the past, is it just our opportunity as physicians and as healthcare providers to say, how much has the tumor grown in its local area? How much has it spread to the surrounding area? And then has it spread elsewhere within the human body? So for colon and rectal cancer, depending on if it's colon cancer or rectal cancer, depends a little bit about what staging tests that we get. So both of them share the ability to get a CAT scan and to get a blood tumor marker called a CEA. And the tumor marker just serves as a baseline that will be tracked further on in the surveillance place. Now, the CAT scans are primarily focused on the chest, the abdomen, and the pelvis. So things that colorectal cancer can spread to, your liver, your lungs, inside of the abdomen proper. And then rectal cancer, again, because it is kind of in a fixed area down, kind of closer to the opening or the anus of your GI tract, the terminal end of it right there, we'll also get an additional what we call MRI. And so an MRI is a little bit different because of the fact that I tell my patients it's like having a really, really great artist draw a picture versus a really good high school artist that a CAT scan can get. So an MRI gives you that detailed findings of not only how much it's grown through the wall, but the surrounding lymph nodes in that area that may affect the way that we treat rectal cancer.
Okay, so to summarize, Once a mass is determined to be malignant, the very first question that we ask ourselves as healthcare providers is, what is the extent of the tumor, of the cancer? And that's defined by the staging. And a major tool of staging is diagnostic radiology, whether it's a CT scan or an MRI. And I like your analogy of the artist. That kind of paints a really nice picture. I think my level of artistry, I'm not sure there's a rudimentary x-ray that would even be helpful for anybody with staging, but I like the analogy between CTs and MRIs. So once the staging has been completed, can you tell us a little bit more about what the different stages are and or treatment options based on those stages, Dr. Steele?
Yeah. So in colorectal cancer, like many other cancers, it's stage 1, 2, 3, and 4. Easiest most people have understood or have heard of stage 4. That's what we call metastatic disease. So the cancer, unfortunately, has found itself in an area outside that local regional area or within just the wall, in our case, of the colon or the rectum alone. So it's gone and spread to the lungs, or it's gone and spread to the liver. It's gone and spread inside of the abdomen, which is something that we call carcinomatosis. Big fancy word that just means there's tumor that's spread inside of your belly in itself, but not lodged into a solid organ like the liver. Going backwards, stage 3 means that it has actually got clinically positive lymph nodes. Now, Mike, here is an important distinction, and it's something that is really a distinguishing characteristic between the rectum and the colon. So in many cases, we use, as you said, radiology tests to give us just a hint that there may be tumor elsewhere, and in this case, in the lymph nodes. And for the colon lymph nodes live in fatty tissue along the blood vessels that feed our colon, come off from the aorta, they go through different blood vessels and they feed different parts of the body, and some of them are the colon. Those lymph nodes live in that fatty package. And in many cases, we can't see for colon cancer whether or not those lymph nodes are positive. We only find out if those lymph nodes are positive after surgery, when the pathologist will chop that area up, they'll look underneath the microscope in those lymph nodes and see if it's positive. So many patients may come and ask me, hey, do I have stage 3? Do I have stage 2? What do I have? For colon cancer, that's really hard to be able to tell. Rectal cancer, because of the specifics of the MRI, and because it actually does potentially change the way that we treat that, is something that we can call a clinically positive lymph node on MRI that is concerning, for example, in this case, stage 3. Again, stage 3 means the cancer has spread to local regional lymph nodes. And because that MRI has got that very fine artistic quality to it, we can see some characteristics of the lymph nodes. For example, they're bigger than they should be. They have the outline that's not a nice round outline, but they're jagged or edged that are concerning for lymph nodes. Now, it is important to understand that it could look that way and it could not have cancer, but that's just how the best that we have here in 2024 to basically tell us whether or not that's concerning for lymph node positivity, and then we treat accordingly. Stage 2 and stage 1, it hasn't spread outside of the wall of the lining itself. So stage 3, it's gone lymph node. Stage 2, it's a bigger tumor that's grown a little bit deeper into the wall of the colon, but it hasn't spread the surrounding organs. And then stage 1, it's a smaller tumor that quite has only invaded just the beginning parts of that colonic layer. So that's the differences in stage.
So obviously, when we talk about colorectal screening and the tools that we have available to us, early detection often leads to, I'm assuming, lower stages, meaning more stage 1 and stage 2, which in turn, hopefully, helps treatment options. So take us a little bit through that, maybe the early stages or maybe stage 1 and 2 or versus 3 and 4, or however you approach it, please let our listeners know.
Yeah, so I think it's important to understand some trends within colorectal cancer and in general. And so the nice thing is that colorectal cancer incidence have steadily decreased since the 1980s. And that's a huge thing. That's unlike some of the other cancers that we do. And truth be told, you had that great podcast that I encourage all the listeners to do about screening for colorectal cancer. And since 2000, that kind of rapid dissemination of colonoscopy has been something that's probably led to that accelerated decline in the incidence and mortality of it. And so finding something before it has spread, and it's important to understand that about 25%, Mike, of all colorectal cancers present at stage 4. And obviously, that's not what we want. And I know you've spoken to the screening about looking at symptoms, and if it's got bleeding or changes in your stool or something's not right, tell that to your physician, tell that to your healthcare provider so we can work it up. But I would tell you that as we approach the staging, again, it's important to understand the differences between colon and rectum about what the next steps are in terms of treatment. So I'm going to start with colon cancer first because that's the easiest one. In general, all comers, we treat colon cancer through a surgical resection. So as I talked about before, the colon and the rectum is about 6 feet in length. And in general, we're going to take out about a foot of that. There's some pluses and minuses and a lot of nuances to this, but in general, we'll take out about a foot of cancer. So we take out margins around the cancer. But I told you before, Mike, that those lymph nodes live along blood vessels, and those blood vessels feed different types of the colon. So we want to get those lymph nodes. So in order to get those lymph nodes, we have to take those blood vessels because that's where they live. And you got to take the corresponding amount of colon that corresponds to that length of colon. So a lot of people will say, can't you just take out a little bit? Unfortunately, you can't because you want to make sure you get that good swath of lymph nodes to make a determination if it's spread in there. So colon is primarily treated surgically. And we take that under pathology. And Mike, that's when we know, is it stage one? Is it stage two? Is it stage three? And obviously the stage four would be hopefully identified on some of our staging examinations with diagnostic radiology. So that's colon cancer, and that's kind of how staging is affected. So even early stage colon cancers are treated primarily by surgery. I know you and I had spoken in the past about some things on the horizon, and there's no question that even through endoscopic means, so through colonoscopy, there are some very early colon cancers we can now take out, preserving the colon, preserving the rectum, and just taking out endoscopically. But that's probably for another talk because that's pretty darn nuanced in it.
So well, I look forward to that talk.
So let's switch to rectal cancer now. Yes. So the difference between rectal cancer, and again, the difference between what we're doing has a lot to do with that, why we use that MRI. So if we can see that the tumor is actually very big and bulky, like a T4. Now the T stage is not stage four. It just means locally, how much has that tumor grown through the wall of the colon? That's called a T stage. The N stage, is it lymph node positive or lymph node negative? And then an M stage is it metastases? And we take that T, that N, and that M, we loop them together and we give you an overall stage. So for rectal cancer, for those that have a locally advanced, a higher T stage, it's grown through the wall, or there's concerning findings of the lymph nodes on MRI, we will treat those type of tumors primarily upfront first, not surgically like colon cancer, but we will give those patients chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And the goal for that is to sterilize those lymph nodes. And Mike, one of the things that's very, not super new on the horizon, but something that a lot of people are going to, such as here at the Cleveland Clinic, is that about a third of those patients will have the cancers completely melt away and will have no clinical evidence of disease. And they won't have to go on to the next thing that we do in that multimodality therapy, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and then surgery. They can avoid surgery altogether. So although the vast majority of rectal cancer patients still may require to have surgery, there's about a third of them that don't. And that's something that has been within the last kind of predominantly 10 years or so that we're doing. And it's still in pockets, it's still in protocols, but is a very exciting thing for us because if you can avoid surgery, and especially if you don't have to have your rectum removed, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. That's great to hear that those advances that are being made. That's just wonderful to learn. And you've done a remarkably nice job distinguishing between colon cancer and rectal cancer, because a lot of times in the community medicine, it gets lumped into one. And what I'm wondering, Dr. Steele, is how the cases that you see or that are out in the community, do you see more rectal cancers or do you see more colon cancers? What is more prevalent?
Yeah, just in general, the colon cancers, probably because it's larger, it's longer, it's bigger, tend to be a lot more. But rectal cancer certainly is increasing. And Mike, this is a sad part about kind of the world in which we live in, and we don't have a great answer why. But I spoke a little bit more about the trends in colorectal cancer being on a steady decline. But one of the trends that we're unfortunately seeing is an alarming rise of those what we call early onset or young onset colorectal cancer centers. And the incidence, what we describe in less than 50-year-olds, has increased by 51% since 1994. And unfortunately, it's expected to continue to rise. So if you look at it, about 11% of colon cancers and about 18% of rectal cancers occur in individuals under the age of 50. Think about that. If you talked about on your great podcast about screening, how we've dropped the screening down to 45 from what used to be 50, and we still have most patients that have under 50. And if you would look at this trend and go forward, Mike, by the year 2030, in less than 50-year-olds, colon cancer increase by twofold and rectal cancer incidence could increase by fourfold. So if you look at it, there's about 18,000 new cases of young onset colorectal cancer center every year in the United States. That is equivalent to 49 a day. And that translates into the current setting of about 3,600 deaths, which is 10 per day. So colorectal cancer has no question a significant impact for our younger patients. And the big question is why? And unfortunately, we don't know. We look at trends, we look at environment, we look at diet, we look at genetics, we look at maybe something that's going on. But unfortunately, there's a lot of investigation that we're doing here also at the Cleveland Clinic. And I can't give you a great reason why that is right now, but it's definitely something that we are investigating. And this is just the average risk person, Mike. This isn't the high risk people, for example, that have inflammatory bowel disease or have some of the polyposis genetic syndromes. This is your average US patient that's out there.
And that's got to be driving the recommendations. I know they recently dropped from 50 and over to 45 and over for the screening tools and recommendations to get screened for it. Just a quick question on the reason why there been any viral link. I know in the ENT world, when we talk in particular tonsillar cancer, we see a big viral link, specifically HPV. I wondered if that has crossed over into your realm.
Yeah, Mike, that's such a great question. That's why you were one of the top students in our medical class together. And I would tell you, very intuitive. What I would tell you is that the virus is in our world in colorectal surgery, but it tends to be more anal cancers, which are squamous cell, just like you have the squames in the upper part of the digestive system. But the colorectal cancers that we primarily deal with are what we call adenocarcinoma, which are glandular. They tend not to have that viral origin like the anal cancers do. But certainly, it could be an oncogenic virus. There's no question about that. We don't know. And now, let's just say this. There's no question that when we look at the multifactorial aspect of cancer development in general, you have to have a host, a person that's kind of prone to what it is. And then there's some risk factors that we know of, things that we do. So people who may have some issues associated with being overweight, high BMI patients, patients who smoke, patients who live a sedentary lifestyle. So we got all these different risk factors that may lead to a higher risk. And some of those are things that we can control, that we can, you know, encourage our patients to have healthy lifestyle habits, because it is lots of different cancers may share that trait. But then it's certainly in the environment of which we live and work around and some of the things that we eat. And then you got to think there is a genetic component to most cancers that we do. So I think that as we dig into this a little bit more, hopefully we will have. We're very blessed here at the Cleveland Clinic to have one of the world's only of its kind, a young onset colorectal cancer center, where we actually, every patient under 50 comes in. It's a multidisciplinary team. We have everybody from psychiatry to reproductive health to a geneticist to radiation oncologist to all sorts of different aspects that want to be able to partner together to investigate. And as a part of this, Mike, we've had a wonderful, wonderful response from our young patients who have donated their tissue from their cancers after we've taken biopsies or taken the specimen out, so we can research this and hopefully come to an answer as to why it's affecting those patients that are young.
Well, I tell you, it is remarkable the innovation that follows the Cleveland Clinic. I mean, your institution as a whole is just always on cutting edge medicine, looking at innovative techniques, treatment options, and really pushing the frontier of medical treatment. I can't thank you enough, Dr. Steele, for being part of the Fortcast today. I've learned so much as usual when I talk to you, whether it's about bourbon or colorectal cancers. It's really been enjoyable. So thank you for joining us today.
Well, I appreciate it, Mike. I appreciate all that you're doing for Central Wisconsin. Obviously, I'm from Northern Wisconsin, and it's always good to talk to somebody from home. And thanks for the honor of being a guest on the Fortcast.
Well, thank you, Dr. Steele. And once again, this is Dr. Michael Anderson on the Fortcast. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it on your social media channels and also check out our full podcast library on our website. So take care, everybody. And until our next podcast, thank you and have a good day. Bye-bye.